Yeah, and I'm just completely blanking on anything anything to say.
And you might want to talk about how they...
Welcome to The Geek in Review, the podcast focused on innovative and creative ideas in the legal industry. I'm Marlene Gebauer.
And I'm Greg Lambert. Well, this week we talk with Astrid Kohlmeier and Mira Klimola about their new publication, The Legal Design Book, Doing Law in the 21st Century. Now, I was really excited to get them on the show, Marlene, as this book is really something to behold. I mean, it doesn't just have great content, but it's also got, it's a wonderful book just to look at.
It's beautiful. I mean, the design elements are just gorgeous, so.
Yeah. And we talked to them, I think that's one of the first things we talked to them about. So, mm-hmm. Well, normally at this time, we would jump into our information inspirations portion of the program. But to be honest with everybody, our day jobs have just been keeping us a little busy lately. So we decided to take a personal privilege this week and skip out on the inspiration. So
on that note, we'll just get right into our interview with Astrid and Mira.
We'd like to welcome Mira Klimera and Astrid Kohlmeier, authors of the legal design book, Doing Law in the 21st Century. Mira and Astrid, welcome to the Geek in Review.
Thank you so much.
Thank you for your invitation. Thanks.
So you are both joining us from Europe. Mira, you're in Helsinki, Finland, and Astrid, I believe you're just outside of Munich. We were talking before we jumped on the time zone differences here.
We're so international today.
Yeah, it's early morning for us and late afternoon for y'all. But I wanted to jump in before we get to the content of the book and take a couple of minutes just to talk about the actual design of the book. I actually had the book laying out on the kitchen table at home, and my wife, who is a middle school librarian, commented on how much she loved the design of the book. So can you tell us about who you worked with on the design of the book and how your interaction went with that designer?
First of all, thank you so much. That this is the best feedback you could give us, to be honest, because it was exactly our intention to have a real user-centric approach also with the book and the layout and design. And that's why we chose Tobias Heumann is his name. He's a graphic designer, and he supported the whole process from A to Z, and it was a real pleasure to work with him together. Mira, maybe you want to add some on that.
Yeah, I think as Astrid said, just hearing that feedback from you, what we wanted was, you know, a legal book that people would also feel proud to have on their coffee table. Collaborating with Tobias was a huge, you know, asset to ensuring that our book not only spoke about legal design, but really embodied legal design philosophies, being visual, easy to understand, you know, something you want to pick up. And throughout the journey, it was a very collaborative approach with Tobias and ourselves back and forward. Him, of course, learning a bit more about the law, and us also kind of diving deeper into what is legal design from a designer's point of view. So there was some good learning in that collaboration.
Putting that multidisciplinary work to work.
Yeah, exactly.
Exactly. So this is one of the ground rules in legal design, that you collaborate actively with different disciplines, and that's why we had to embody that in our concept as well.
Yeah, and I have to say the design is great. It continues through the book. There's lots of white space. The fonts are great. Very, very enjoyable read.
Maybe another point on that is that we really, you know, there are so many publications out there that just do not fulfill the goal that you really engage with the book. And maybe this is also something new to the legal industry and education, that we wanted to trigger a little bit and also lay out a new concept.
Yeah, I can tell you all the law books I ever read have tiny, tiny little print. They just cram as much as they can onto one page. So this is very refreshing. You start off the book by giving the reader 10 legal design philosophies, and you recommend that we should get to know these philosophies. What's the value you find from being familiar with these legal design philosophies?
I start with saying that it really sets out the ground rules for being able to participate and conduct a legal design project in your own organization. The legal design philosophy prepares a setting to create collaboratively, and it makes sure that you are really building on each other without judgment, for example, and makes true collaborative approach possible from the very beginning, because this is something we sometimes miss in the legal industry so far, this radical collaborational approach that we haven't established yet. And with this 10 philosophies, you could start thinking in the right direction and set the ground rules. And maybe Mira, you go on the specifics in the 10 philosophies.
Yeah, I think it's really about establishing the right mental models here, because we can't just use our traditional legal mindsets to then work as legal designers or really implement legal design. It really takes coming from a different perspective and onboarding a different mindset. So that's why before we can get started, before you can really prove and create value within your company, everyone participating in legal design has to have the right mindset. So there, I'm not going to list them all, but it's things like curiosity and creativity, deferring judgment of yourself and others, embracing failure and failing fast. So really switching that narrative of failure as being something that should be feared and kind of something that as lawyers would translate across to complacency, shifting that narrative to failure being an opportunity to learn. And it's always part of the innovation process. You can't create anything good or new or great without taking some small risks, and failure is part of that process. We have things around diversity and then the art of pivoting. So not being so fixed on a path that you've set, but seeing what user feedback is. And if the users and your clients are telling you something different to what you have envisioned, taking that on board and being open to pivoting. So these 10 philosophies are really about getting everyone into the right mental model so that you and your team and the group that you're working with can go on successfully. So these are just a few of the mental models that we establish in these 10 legal design philosophies.
Right. I think one of the things that's of value to having these philosophies is I think lawyers or those of us in the legal field are used to following a set of rules. And almost you can almost think of these as, okay, here's your rules. Here's the order.
Here's the precedent.
Yeah, exactly.
Mm-hmm. A set of ground rules, as Astrid said. Yeah.
So there's a quote that you use from the Cox Review of Creativity in Business, and it's all the way back in 2005, that really stood out to me. And that quote is, "Design is what links creativity and innovation." And the reason that this stood out is because the theme of this podcast is actually that we're focused on innovation and creativity and creative ideas in the legal industry. So apparently Marlene and I have created a sort of legal design podcast, and we didn't actually even realize it.
This makes me so happy.
So help us understand what your view of design is and how you think that that works its way into what you're calling legal design.
Well, here and what we really try to emphasize in our book is that design is very much multifaceted. So a lot of the time, people in the legal profession and just generally, we equate design to aesthetics and visuals. And that's a myth that we really sought to dispel in our book, to really make sure that everyone has an understanding of how holistic design is. So here for us, design is a mindset, so a way of viewing problems and a way of solving problems. It's a process, and this is where we go into the design thinking process, which is really core to innovation. And then we have design as a skill set. So here we have things like organization design, visual design, user interaction design. We've got both tangible and intangible design that we flesh out so that everyone understands that when we talk about legal design, it's applying design in this holistic definition to solve legal challenges and problems.
Yes, and the reason why we approached it like this was that we saw in our practice and experience that there is kind of a misunderstanding or a lack of knowledge, especially in the legal industry when we talk about design. And lawyers also tended to jump very quickly to the conclusion that they are themselves legal designers when concluding, for example, a workshop on legal design once for 2 days or whatever. And we wanted to show that design is in itself our own profession, as the profession of law is one profession in itself. And we wanted to prevent people to easily or too easily jump to the conclusion that they know everything about design when it comes to the law and legal design. Because at the beginning, especially, it was more the perception that everything has to do with aesthetic graphics only. But as Mira said, it is crucial for us to make people understand that we adopt also the whole process of how designers work, how designers go in their process, and how they then find solution with a number of skills that you have to learn, as well as we have to learn the law. It takes time and also experience and exercise to come to a very good conclusion then at the end. And since just the last sentence on that, we are not, or most of us are not trained in two professions or three professions, we advocate that if you are not able to have all the skills within yourself, then again, go and look for other designers to collaborate with and find the translation or a good briefing and a good communication together, so then that you then together come to a good conclusion.
A lot of the advancements that we've seen in the legal industry are a result of how we come to consume information. You mentioned the need to use correct vocabulary, specifically around the three words of digitization, digitalization, and digital transformation. Ooh, I got that right. How do these three phases help us as we begin to understand legal design thinking?
Let me answer that. So we wanted to lay out these expressions or declare or explain the expressions better, because we saw there is often also a misunderstanding of those expressions. And it's easy to think you are doing digital transformation if you just think about digitalizing something. And that is just not true. So there are different levels and different stages of digitalization or digitization. And it's super interesting because in German, for example, we do not have the differentiation between digitization and digitalization, whereas you do have it in English. In Germany, for example, everything is digitalization. But in your language, it is digitization, which is the representation of what already exists. And the digitalization, which means making already digitized material more accessible. And digital transformation, on the other hand, is something that is bigger than only digitization and digitization. Because with digital transformation, you come to even disruptive elements. You do things totally differently and don't only represent, for example, a PDF, for example, is a very good example. It's only a representation of a, let's say it's a picture, a digitalized picture that you can use. But if you have digital transformation in your head, it comes to disruption. You search for different flows, for different digital solutions on every step in the customer or the journey that you have to find a solution for. And it connects differently and has different touch points. That's why it is so important to differentiate between this simple digitization, the middle step, which is digitalization, so a little bit more, and digital transformation that leads you into another digital sphere, let's say.
You observe something in your writings that comes as a result of these outside the norm ideas, and that's what you call innovation after 6 p.m. only. Can you explain what you mean by this?
Yeah. It's a concept that I think most people would be familiar with. And really what we mean by this is the fact that innovation, or the role of being an innovator, isn't necessarily, or it isn't, incorporated into what is seen as a lawyer's role. It's often what we observe from our clients and people speaking in the industry is that innovation is seen as an add-on task to what lawyers do. It's not something that's built into their role itself. So what we have is just people who are executing their everyday role as a lawyer, and then we have a few enthusiastic people who are then putting in that extra time to do innovation. So it's innovation after 6 p.m. only. And of course, that takes extra effort, extra motivation, but it also kind of speaks to perhaps a culture of the legal industry here, and maybe a reason as to why we as an industry haven't been innovating at the speed that perhaps other industries have been.
Yeah, exactly. So what we observe is that especially legal organizations lack an innovation strategy often, because we as lawyers do not learn all of that, what we are talking about in our book. And this is also a reason why we have this observation that many legal organizations do not have an innovation strategy, which means that the whole organization has to believe and also lead in the same direction when it comes to innovation. Innovation is not something that you do in a silo. Innovation is something that has to be embodied in the DNA of every company, of every organization, of also legal teams and legal organizations per se. And that is just another reason why we called it innovation after six only. And we wanted to have this picture that it's just not sufficient enough to put everything in extra work after a normal work. Innovation has to be embodied in your normal work. And together in your team, you have to follow the same direction.
Because that's how you will succeed in terms of competitive advantage, customer success, yourself as a developing professional too. And I think when we can really move from this innovation after 6 p.m. mindset to innovating being part of the lawyer's everyday role, will also reduce this concept of innovation theater, which I think a lot of people have been speaking about too.
Yeah, that reminds me of a conversation we had a couple of weeks ago with Mary O'Carroll. One of the things that Mary said, and leave it up to the legal industry to kind of screw something up that's good when it comes to they're actually creating these innovation labs or these kind of unique systems within a law firm to dip their toe into the innovation and try to make it part of the culture. But the in-house attorneys who use these firms are seeing it more as, okay, the innovation is happening over here on this side and you're getting all this PR out of it, but you're still doing the same work on my stuff that you're always doing. I'm not seeing that innovation. So in your research, were you seeing anything where law firms specifically were adopting these innovations, but they were almost taking your after 6 p.m. and just saying, okay, but innovation only in this laboratory. Everyone else, do your own work, but the innovation's happening over here. Were you seeing that?
Yeah, and I think this is also what you touch on here is this concept of innovation theater, you know, using and creating innovation labs, innovation committees, innovation, you know, groups, etc. But they are working in that silo. And a lot of it may be more about incremental innovation, not really about doing something more transformative. And again, siloing people off and saying, this is the innovation team and they'll work in this area, in this playground. But on a positive note, what I'd like to bring to the table is that both Astrid and I have worked with some really big law firms here, and they're using legal design as a tool and a methodology to kind of stop this silo way of thinking about innovation and instead bring on tools and skills into every lawyer's toolkit so that they can be innovating with their clients, and it's going to a place where words and actions are aligning. So there's some positivity there too that I wanted to highlight.
In that context, I have to add, because this was the origin of your question, there is even one tangible example in the book from Clifford Chance that I did together with Clifford Chance Germany, where we especially thought about how to build up the German innovation hub of Clifford Chance in order to be user-centered. And it was a very bold step also from the department in Germany of Clifford to lay their hands into the new methodology of legal design. And I have to say that it was a huge success. And even now, they are still benefiting from the research we did there to find out what the needs of users of such an innovation are. And it's also laid out very well in this use case, in the use case section in our book. And because you started with the innovation hub question, that is a very positive example from one of the largest law firms in the world, how we can change that.
You lay out these six steps in the legal design process, and there's team and culture building, research and understand, synthesize and define, idea development and conception, prototyping and testing, and implementation. I actually used these in a presentation that I gave to a law school last week, and it really helped kind of define this. But how difficult is it for some legal teams or law firms and or legal departments just to get past the teams and culture building step of this? Because that's a huge step for them to take.
Getting past this culture building step is an interesting question, because you never get past the culture building step. I would say the culture building is an ongoing process that you fulfill all the time, but you can start with building the right culture, for example, with implementing the 10 philosophy mindset that we have in the beginning of our book. But I know where your question leads. So how difficult is it to get past the culture building as ground rules? It depends, I would say. And it depends where you are now, whether you are in an in-house organization or in a law firm. In that respect, I could it depends. It's a lawyer's answer,
yes,
I know.
Yeah, that's why I was laughing.
But we're still lawyers, but that is correct. But I have to say that in-house organizations are just a little bit advanced when it comes to getting past the culture building step.
I would agree,
because they have more exercise in that out of the company's philosophies and the innovation activities that are going on in companies, whereas law firms are maybe not that advanced yet. But I don't say that they can go there, but it still needs more effort now to get there. And Mira, maybe you want to add something.
Well, I wonder if that goes back to another philosophy that law firms tend to fall victim to, and that is they tend not to do something if it's not perfect. And I wonder if it's not seen as culture that's totally ingrained and ready to go, if that until that's done, then they're afraid to move on to that next step. I wonder if that's part of it as well.
Yeah, that's certainly part of it. And I'd like to highlight what Astrid said, the culture building never ends. It continues, and it should evolve as your company and the company's goals evolve, of course, as well. But then what you said about prototyping and testing, is that something that's uncomfortable? There are steps in the process. Both Astrid and I have done some deeper research on which of these steps are kind of more comfortable or less comfortable for legal professionals. And what stands out the most is step two, which is research and understanding. So actually legal professionals find it quite difficult to build that empathy part, more because we are trained to be advice givers. So we're trained to be providing the solutions and doing the talking, And whereas when you are building empathy, it's all about stepping into the shoes of your client to see from your client's perspective. So that's a kind of different mental model to put into place. Lawyers are good at it when they do it, but it takes a little bit more effort. And then the second one that is quite often very difficult is what you said around prototyping and testing, Greg. And that comes from that innate culture that we don't put up a rough, scrappy prototype of anything. You know, if you think about juniors within the legal sector, even when you create a draft, your draft is pretty much perfect, right? You're hoping you don't get too many red marks from someone who's more senior than you. But here, prototyping and testing, it's really a prototype. Like, okay, you want to concept an idea, do a rough sketch of it and get questions, get feedback, start a dialogue. And that feels really uncomfortable. But once lawyers get over that and start understanding, hey, this is actually a way of working more iteratively. It's a way of getting feedback quickly so that we can progress faster. You're going to see numerous benefits. But yes, both of those, research and understanding and prototyping and testing, are typically where lawyers feel less comfortable.
One adding on that, yes, they feel more uncomfortable. But on the other hand, this process that we also have in legal design and the process step at the beginning is very analytical. And this analytical capabilities we do have as lawyers. And that's why I also think that legal design is fitting to our mindset that we established through universities and law schools already. So there's also this positive side here that is very logical and analytical and inviting for lawyers, therefore.
Now, once you get past the six steps of the process, you start talking about the role of legal designers. And so I want you to explain what's the profile of a legal designer and where does this legal designer typically sit within an organization?
So first of all, the profile of the legal designer is something we put together by ourselves, and we also created this profile of legal designer that is consisting of law, design, a good understanding of tech and especially legal tech, but also business and operations. And we call it also attitude and behavior. So this is, let's say, the outline of the profile that we see as a round and floating model, let's say. So
yeah, I think words there are around how, like, the amount of depth that you would have in those areas, technology, business operations, attitudes in particular, would change depending on the legal design project that you have. So law and design is really at the core of what a legal designer has, but a legal designer is very holistic as a professional. So they do need technological knowledge, business and operations, attitudes and behavior. But depending on the focus of the legal design project, you may bring in more or less of those floating aspects. And the other thing that would be important to highlight here is our floating model, which outlines this legal design professional's profile, is in flux. So this is currently its state, but we also need to be open to this model evolving as our world evolves too. And that's something that's really important for Astrid and I, that people understand this is the model now, but it's in flux and it may be built on or reduced, etc., going forward.
We came to that because we saw that there are different profiles also out there. For example, the T-shaped lawyer that we already know. And what we just missed, or what we see in the legal design profession, is this huge capability of design that is still lacking, even though the T-shaped lawyer still has, or as a first concept, has also design thinking in itself. But on the other hand, we need more design if we want to do legal design projects. And this is also what we wanted to highlight with the floating model. And as Mara said, it's in flux, it's in development, it is not fixed. And this is one of the major reasons, or the most important reason, that we don't see it as a fixed model yet, but it's a beginning. And all of those capabilities that we mentioned, they're just floating around in that floating system. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So is the floating model describing where they fit, or is there a preferable place for these legal designers to be located within the organization?
No, floating model is more about thinking of those five areas of expertise coming in and out based on needs, but where legal designers will sit in the organization. That's a really good question, because what we have seen in the past 12 months is a real formalizing of the legal designer role. And we're seeing within in-house as well as law firms, legal designers now being hired and advertised and jobs. So we would see the role of a legal designer being quite flexible here. But a few that we really touched upon is, of course, as like a head legal designer, also someone who could be heading up your kind of client experience and representing the voice of clients, because at the heart of the legal designer's skill set with the design aspect is all that knowledge around design thinking, user centricity, co-creating with your clients. So kind of a head of client experience. Then, of course, they would make a great fit within any innovation role within an organization as well. So these are some of the like three key areas that we would see legal designers fitting into a legal ecosystem.
We've spent a lot of time talking about legal design and legal designers within legal organizations providing services. But what about the end user of these services? And I love that you refer to them as LUX, for legal user experience. So what makes for a good legal user experience?
A great experience would be that you don't even recognize that you have, for example, a legal service going on. That would be the ultimate goal of the intuitive experience. And this is why we build it this pyramid of different levels, where we have at the bottom the profound legal advice and expertise as we know it in the traditional service. In the middle ground, we have the user friendliness, which is one step further into an intuitive experience, where you occupy yourself with the real needs of real users and find a solution for them that makes it easier to understand the legal content, for example, and also makes it more transparent how the, certain services in the legal industries are fulfilled. But if you come to intuitive experiences, so at the top of the pyramid, then we really talk about this delightful experiences in the legal field. So where you have maybe a legal problem, but the answer for that lies, for example, in a digital service or a digital app that you might use and don't even feel that you are dealing with a legal question anymore. So that is the ultimate goal that we are trying to achieve. And the work, or let's say to achieve that, it means to invest a lot of time and work, because even all the instruments that we are using all the time, like our mobile phones, are built on design thinking and user centricity. And to come to services that we are using 24/7, it needs sometimes a whole team to come up and occupy themselves with what you really need as a user. And this is just the equivalent in the legal industry, is the legal user experience.
That's a great answer. I love the thought of obtaining legal service without having that feeling that you're obtaining some legal service. That's good. That could be applied to a few other industries. I was thinking a dentist going. It'd be great to go to the dentist and not feel like you're getting a dental experience. So.
Yeah.
You can't pick up a management book these days since probably the days of Peter Drucker without some variation of the phrase that you can't manage what you can't measure. And so how do you measure the value, the success, and the return on investment for legal design?
Really good question. And I think this is something that we advocate in our book that we need to do more of in the legal industry, setting KPIs, key performance indicators, and measuring the success of our different projects. And that's one key element of all legal design projects here. I won't go into all of the different KPIs because we have, I think, like quite a few pages dedicated to listed KPIs in our book. But at a high level, we look at Qs, so Q-U-E, quality. So they're setting your key performance indicators around what kind of results were obtained, how accurate and reliable the results are. Then in U is user satisfaction, so a more qualitative style of key performance indicators, looking at what was client feedback, how did users respond, were people delighted, what was the overall emotional reaction as well as kind of quantitative reaction. And then in terms of effectiveness, these are more kind of quantitative metrics around speed and efficiency. So if you're redesigning a contract, how many times does it go back and forward between parties before it's finalized? Are there ways to streamline that process? And if so, by how many steps did you reduce that process with the legal design project? In terms of readability, how quickly can people read through key terms? How many hands does it pass through? How understandable was the content? So there are a few different metrics that we tend to set in all of our legal design projects.
It always needs a comparison between the before and the after if you talk about measurement and KPIs. And what we observe and see in our daily practice is that the before is often in legal organizations not laid out yet. So they just do not measure enough at the moment. And in our projects, when we ask at the beginning of what KPIs do you wanna transform, where do you wanna get better, then we often get the look of what do you mean? Because it's the only measurement or KPI that they have at the moment is often the billable hours system. Mm-hmm. And not so much else. And we as legal designers can also train legal organizations in having the capability and the start of how to measure anything. Because it's astonishing that it's not so much out there that organizations measure at the moment. And we advocate to start simple, and you do not need fancy technology for that. You can just think of all the things that just Mira said. You don't need complicated technique for that. You need only at the beginning the thought, where do I want to get better? Where do I have problems? And what is my original, what is my blank page? So where do I start?
Yeah. As you were talking about, kind of take a snapshot of where we are so that you can see at the end, where we've come. It's almost like if you're redesigning your kitchen, you want to take a picture of what it looked like before so that you can actually see and measure the difference and not just feel the difference, but actually have something tangible to look at. So I think that's great advice. Yeah. And I think you're right. We don't measure enough as it is. So it's going to be really hard to all of a sudden pick up that habit going forward as well. Mm-hmm.
So the book has been out for about a month now, right?
Yes.
Something like that.
So I imagine you had fun teaming up together to do this. But Astrid, I'll start with you. What's next on the agenda for you?
Next on the agenda is that the release of the German version in just 6 days.
Yes. <So it's
laughs> and Mira?
Yeah, we've got Astrid and I are so excited for the launch of the German version. But continuing on, we have a few talks and discussions on this book, and each of us have some different projects as well as teaching at various academies and universities. So just really starting to build and continue building the legal design movement. That's something that's our mission, I guess.
And also educating people in that field. And I have a new intern right now in my consultancies. And this is, for example, one thing that I really love, you have one person that you can educate the whole day. And that is, you know, we have to be more legal designers out there. And we are the ones who are responsible for education at the moment. So that's the thing. Yeah.
Well, I know the book is getting rave reviews. And it's really interesting because although you two are not in the United States, as I'm reading through this, it applies very much, I think, universally.
Yeah.
So it's you've done a good job of making this not just easy to read, but easy to apply, regardless, I think, of where you are. So well done.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
I mean, legal design has no boundaries here. It has no borders. It's not jurisdiction-based because it's really a methodology to improve legal services and industries and teams. So really happy to hear people in the U.S. are also getting excited about the work.
Very nicely put. Well, Mira Klimola and Astrid Kohlmeier, authors of the legal design book, Doing Law in the 21st Century, thanks for talking with us.
Super fun.
Thank you so much.
So I really enjoyed talking with both of them, and I really enjoyed the part towards the end where they were talking about how is it that we measure the return on investment for this, and the fact that we really only have like one or two measurements that we use in law firms, and that is, you know, revenue and time. You know, this is going to be pretty difficult, I think, if those are the only two things that we know how to measure now. If we start improving the process and the design of the services, we really need to start looking more at what we're doing now and then seeing how that actually improves. So I'm glad they brought that up.
I like this idea about legal designers within legal organizations providing services. That's a pretty unique idea. I don't think I know any legal designers that are in law firms, for example. And, you know, I think that would be quite disruptive.
Yeah, and I think the way that they were kind of mentioning about it, there's some titles that they talked about that I don't think we necessarily think about design, and that is, you know, the client experience person. There's these new chief levels out there that talk about working with the clients. I think those are the legal designers now. It'd be interesting to see what they morph into as we go along.
Yeah, I think this is going to be a moving area, I think, in law.
Definitely. So if you're in one of those moving positions, I highly suggest that you go out and buy the legal design book. So thanks again to Astrid Kohlmeier and Mira Klimola for taking the time to talk with us.
Thanks for taking the time to listen to the Geek and Review podcast. If you enjoyed the show, share it with a colleague. We'd love to hear from you, so reach out to us on social media. I can be found at GabeBauerM on Twitter.
And you can reach me at Glambert on Twitter.
Or you can leave us a voicemail on the Geek & Review hotline at 713-487-7270. And as always, the music you hear is from Jerry David DeSica. Thank you, Jerry.
Thanks, Jerry. All right, Marlene, I will talk with you later.
Okay, back to work. Bye.
Hey!